Welcome to the Education Gadfly Show. I'm your host, Mike Petrilli of the Thomas B. Fordham Institute. Today, Bill McKenzie, a senior editorial advisor at the George W. Bush Institute, joins us to discuss the state takeover of Houston ISD and its crusading new superintendent. Then, on the Research Minute, Amber discusses a new study that finds increased academic achievement and reduced disparities from a Los Angeles school choice policy. All that on the Education Gadfly Show.
This is the Education Gadfly Show.
I wore a brand new pink sport coat to the movies.
What does Gadfly say?
Hello, this is your host, Mike Petrilli of Thomas B. Fordham Institute, here at the Education Gadfly Show and online at fordhaminstitute.org. And now, please welcome our special guest for this week, William McKenzie. Bill, welcome to the show.
Thank you, Mike, very much. Glad to be here.
Well, great to have you on. Bill is a senior editorial advisor at the George W. Bush Institute. Also joining us, as always, David Griffith.
Hey, Mike. Always a pleasure.
Yeah, great to have you here. Hopefully, the listeners will not hear the pounding in the background here at my house, where we are having a little fix to our roof, thanks to a storm a few weeks ago that landed an enormous branch through our roof. So these are the things that happen. I don't know, David. It seems like a lot of strange weather recently, and I just can't figure out why.
It's a metaphor for something, Mike. Like, maybe we have to get our act together in education reform, something like that.
Oh, okay, good. It's not about climate change, it's about education reform.
Oh, yeah, it might be about that, too. You're right.
Okay. Well, hey, Bill, so glad that you could join us. Bill is here to talk about what the heck is going on in Houston. Some of us have been reading about the Houston Independent School District in the national press about the fact that the state has taken over the schools, sent in a new superintendent, and is making waves. And we are curious how we got to this point and what Bill can tell us about the history of Houston education reform. Let's do that on Ed Reform Update. All right, Bill, you've written a little bit about this. You've been tracking it. Tell us, first of all, how we got to this point. Why is it that the state of Texas moved to, replace the Houston school board and the superintendent?
All right. Well, let me give you a little bit of background over the last three decades, and I'll do it fast. So in the 90s, Houston was really an exemplar in terms of its governance, in terms of its innovation, in terms of its ecosystem. And it pretty much had all three. And let me preface it by saying, no school district is perfect. It will not be perfect under Mike Miles now. So there is no magic solution. But those three are really fundamental, and Houston had them. They had a couple of different superintendents who helped them win the Broad Prize. They had a school board that was made up of members who are really focused on data-driven instruction and innovation, tried and true practices as well. And they had a very supportive community ecosystem that backed the reforms that were being put in place over time. And Houston had that for a good while. And so as recently as 2011, those were still in place. And a group from Dallas went around the country looking at various districts that were showing some progress. And again, I want to make sure this is incremental progress. This is progress. It isn't just, you know, home run after home run. But we looked at a number of different places. I traveled with this group and we went to Houston. That was our last stop, and met with trustees then, met with others within the district. And so leaders here in Dallas looked at the reforms that Houston, these other districts were adopting, and really started putting their weight behind the fundamentals that had changed some of these districts. And that led to Mike Miles being hired as the school superintendent here in Dallas in 2012. So for about 20 years there, Houston had it. And then for a series of different reasons, it started to lose it. And my colleague Ann Wicks and I wrote about this in a series we're calling The Texas Story. For our Bush Center website, we were looking at three big urban districts in Texas, Houston, Dallas, and Austin. And so Houston, again, was the exemplar, Broad Prize winner, et cetera. And it started to lose some of that big mo. And in the ecosystem, some of its leaders had retired. In some cases, they had passed away. The trustee, the school board turnover, and it led to some members that were not in the reform camp, if you will. Terry Greer was their last reform-minded superintendent, and he left, you know, I forgot the exact dates when he left, but he left several years ago. And so Houston lost what it once had in terms of governance and innovation and ecosystems. And then eventually the state started talking about having to take it over. This is pre-pandemic in 19, I believe it was, 2019. And eventually what happened was they had one school, Phyllis Wheatley, that had been consistently failing. And under a law that a Black Democratic state representative, Harold Dutton, had authored, the state had the responsibility to go in and take over a school district that had had this type of failing performance in a school. And so they had put it off and put it off, and there was a court battle. And eventually the Texas Education Agency prevailed in the court battle, and it led to Mike Morath, the Texas Education Commissioner, who's been there since probably 2015, to name Mike Miles as superintendent.
Wow. It's quite a story. Now, one wrinkle is you hear people defending the school district saying, hey, in the most recent rating, Houston got a B in the state support card. And a lot of people thought that the superintendent, the most recent superintendent, was actually pretty good. So, I mean, are those criticisms fair? Or is it the case that this is still a school district that was struggling mightily?
In terms of superintendent, let me deal with it first. He had only been there for a short period of time. And in fairness to him, he probably hadn't been there long enough to really push through a number of reforms. They had some interims and they had not worked out. The board was still not supportive of a number of, there was a lot of fighting, infighting within the board. And so, yeah, it got to be. I don't know what it will get when the new ratings come out in a few weeks, because the criterion by which those districts are judged will get a little tougher. We have like three buckets that you're assessed by. I happen to sit on a commission that advises the schools, the state education commissioner, on those three buckets and what goes into them. But I don't know what it'll be this in about 3 weeks.
Well, let's talk. No, that's helpful. Well, so let's talk about Mike Miles. So you saw him up close and personal when he was in Dallas.
A lot.
Right. And he's one of these characters. It feels like, you know, a flash from the past, in that we used to have a bunch of these leaders, non-traditional. Mike was a West Point grad, right? He came out of the military experience. We tried that for a while back in the day, in the 90s and 2000s, and then that kind of went out of vogue again. So here comes Mike again. Tell us about what he was like in Dallas and how that's now going in Houston.
And I should add, he not only was a former Army Ranger, he also was a State Department diplomat. And so he was both. He is very focused and he is a big picture thinker. He thinks about how you change systems. And to me, and why I wrote the column I wrote for the Dallas Morning News earlier this summer about what he could do, but his new role in Houston is, I think what's exciting and important is he is attempting to transform a big urban school district. And the story of that has legs beyond Houston. It would impact, if it goes in the right way, it could have lessons learned for other big urban districts. So he's very focused and he thinks in terms, he's very open to using data to drive instruction. When he came here in 2012, he focused on trying to develop better principal leaders. There was already a movement in place that he embraced and pushed about more accurate and reliable evaluations of teachers and principals. He had a laser-like focus, that word again, on improving classroom instruction. And he was very big on trying to move the highest performing teachers within the Dallas Independent School District to the lowest performing schools and giving them a financial bump to go do that. I went with him a number of times when he was superintendent in to visit schools. Usually what would happen is he would go in unannounced. It wasn't Mike Wallace style where he'd go banging on the door. He'd go in. He would ask to meet with the principal, the assistant principal. They didn't know he was coming. Usually the eyes would get kind of big. And then he would go tour the school and he'd go into classrooms. And more often than not, what would happen was he would observe the classroom instruction and then he would come back out and meet with the whatever principles with him and the teacher and go over some observations that he saw, not all of which were critical. I mean, there were also things where he was praising the teachers for what they were doing. But he was doing this symbolically to put a huge emphasis on improving classroom instruction. And I remember one time we came out of a junior high or middle school class, and the teacher had already gone on, the principal had gone on, and he kind of, you know, lamented. He said, this class is not going to be on course, you know, to meet the state standards, because within that very class, the teacher was not on course. And he could tell immediately that this instruction was not effective, that the teacher was going off course. And that was his observation just immediately, that this was not going to be good in the end. But he was doing so because he wanted to put this emphasis on that. I think it's also this program that he set up called Accelerated Campus Excellence was this program that moved high-performing teachers to low-performing schools. And again, I don't believe in the silver bullet magic solution for schools. Some of those schools are still struggling within Dallas, but a number of others really improved. And I went into those schools and have written about those schools. And you can really see the change. You could hear the teachers talk about it. You could go in they had data rooms where they go over data about where the kids were in school. And, you know, I remember one teacher telling me, we never did this before. I also remember a teacher telling me when he was observing her room, the teacher told me outside in the hallway, she goes, nobody's ever done that for me before. And I was in the office of one principal when it was announced that he was leaving after 3 years, and she almost was weeping, you know, because she saw what he represented.
Wow, it's fascinating. You know, we have covered that program here on the show quite a bit, the studies of that initiative, and it was very impressive that at least as long as it lasted, right, David, that there was a big impact. If the, you know, when you pay enough money to get teachers to actually move and stay there, you do it in groups, it can have an impact. But once the money ran out, it seems like a lot of the impact ran out as well. David, what else is on your mind as you think about this back to the future in education reform effort down there in Houston?
Yeah, well, I guess the question of sustainability and generalizability, I mean, is on my mind. We need transformative leaders, right? And it's sort of, I don't want to suggest that we don't need them, because we do need them. They founded most charter schools. They're responsible for you know, most of the change we've seen in traditional public schools in the last 20 years. But I always get a little bit worried when I hear that, you know, it's like the force of somebody's personality is what we're putting all our eggs in. I guess I'm just curious to know if you think that some of these changes can stick, and if so, why? And what is it that really will allow them to stick, you know, when he inevitably moves on to the next thing?
Well, some good news there. In Dallas, most of his major reforms stuck. He left after 3 years. The board didn't support him on some key measures, and he left. And so the successor, Michael Hinojosa, kept this accelerated campus excellence program. The teacher evaluation system remains in place. Those are two big miles reforms. So that's the good news. As far as forced personality goes, I mean, Mike Miles, he's not the guy who's going to put his arm around you and give you a big bear hug. You just need to know that. That's just who he is. He is not a natural politician in the, you know, worker crowd in a Tip O'Neill big bear hug type way. That's just not who he is. He's not made that way constitutionally. So I think what he does is he has put in some programs that the data shows make a difference. And Mike alluded to this ACE program. RAND did a study on it not long ago, which showed some progress. And so I think that's what will make a difference if given the right amount of time to implement.
All right. Well, we will need to leave it there. Bill McKenzie from the George W. Bush Institute, thank you for giving us some insight into what's happening in Houston. We were going to root for its success.
Thank you all very much. I appreciate it.
All right. Now it's time for everyone's favorite, Amber's Research Minute. Amber, welcome back to the show.
Thanks, Mike.
Just got to hear a bunch about Houston and Mike Miles taking it by storm. You know, just before we recorded, there was an article I read about how they put on a musical. Houston, you know, Education Reform, the musical that Mike Miles, I guess, helped to design. And I think he did some singing and dancing in.
What?
Good thing we never do anything like that at Fordham, right, Mike?
Never. We would never do something
beneath
like that.
Us.
Exactly. It's been a while, people. Some of our listeners don't even know what we're talking about. You got to go
in the archives.
Go look it up. YouTube, Education Gadfly, What Does the Gadfly Say, among others.
Right, because it worked out so well in Houston, right, Mike?
It sounds like it was not, uniformly popular in Houston. That, I don't know, some kind of musical about how terrible the school district was before Mike Miles arrived. I don't know. Look, what did you call it? Transformational leadership?
That's right.
Unconventional.
Unconventional there. That's the right word for it.
And I thought we were going to talk about me seeing Barbie this weekend.
Darn. Oh, I saw it too.
I saw it too.
No way. Really?
No, really. I did.
All three of us. That's amazing. Yeah. So,
wow.
What does that mean that we all saw Barbie and that we also, all three of us, waited so long?
I think it means we're busy, Mike. I have to say, I was entertained.
I was too.
Entertaining.
Yes. I even laughed more than once.
I wore a brand new pink sport coat to the movies.
Now we need to see that one.
Uh-huh. Oh, you will. All right, Amber. Well, back here in the real world, what you got for us?
We have a new NBER study that examines the impact of public school choice as experienced in the Los Angeles Zones of Choice, or ZOC. I didn't know too much about this, so this is interesting. The ZOC began in 2010 and expanded students' high school options by combining catchment areas into choice zones. Parents of eighth grade students submit zone-specific applications that contain their rank-ordered preferences. The program, just a little history, it started as a pilot due to overcrowded schools, and then was expanded again in 2010, allows high schools to know where their pool of future students is now enrolled. So they often host information sessions at feeder middle schools or candidate high schools. Schools that are overprescribed, they fill their seats using randomly assigned lottery seats. Otherwise, assignments are determined using a centralized algorithm. I'm not going to get into the centralized algorithm. Roughly 65 to 70% of applicants list a school not in their neighborhood as their first preference. Approximately 30% of applicants enroll in a school that is not their neighborhood school due to capacity restraints. But that's a big boost. It used to be 7% in the year before the ZOC expansion took place. So you've got a lot more students not enrolled in their neighborhood zone school. LAUSD, as we know, has been experiencing enrollment drops. So many schools are now able to absorb additional students when they weren't able to before, which presumably makes the threat of competition more salient, since student enrollment losses impact staffing numbers. Analysts use data for all students enrolled in LAUSD school district between 2008 and 2019, restricting again the sample to the high school. So they're looking at student observations in the 11th grade, they exclude special education schools, magnet schools that don't have neighborhood assignments, and schools that were open before the ZOC expansion. So they want to have a core set of schools here to look across time. They use a difference in differences design that compares changes in achievement between ZOC students and non-ZOC students. Specifically, they match each school to a non-ZOC comparable school in the same poverty share and Hispanic share deciles. Man, they have addresses, test score data, demographic data, school assignment preferences, college outcome data from the student clearinghouse. So a boatload of data. The results: analysts find large positive effects of ZOC on student achievement and four-year enrollment rates. Their estimates reveal that by the sixth year of the program, ZOC students' English and ELA exam performance improved by 0.16 standard deviation relative to comparable non-ZOC students. ZOC also raised four-year college enrollment by roughly 5 percentage points, which was a 25% increase from the baseline ZOC student mean. mostly driven by increases in enrollment at Cal State campuses. So they basically say, you know, these effects led to significant reductions in between neighborhood inequality in education outcomes. Then the standard, they're trying to say, okay, you know, where did these impacts occur? So they decompose the achievement impacts. They show that improvements in school quality mostly explain the effects. They also find that improvements in school quality were concentrated among the lowest performing schools in the bottom half of the effectiveness distribution. And then they're like, okay, are these really competitive effects? So then they look at, you know, where the schools were exposed to more competition, and they found that those families placed significant weight on the school's academic quality when they were looking at the effects, providing schools, again, with some competition-induced incentives. And then they try to figure out what's going on. Last bit here, and they dig into the institutional features of the ZOC that may help explain these positive effects. First, they say there's a lack of choice overload so that parents aren't overwhelmed. ZOC choice sets include at most 5 campuses to choose from, which is apparently a significant reduction in comparison to the choice settings in New York City, for example. So they say, you know what, these parents don't have information barriers that may be occurring in other places. And then the kids are very homogenous within each of these zones. So they said, you know what, they sort of look a lot alike, low-income, Hispanic, not a, you know, so they're not selecting schools on income or race, which again gives rise, you know, that they might be choosing peer quality, for instance, but they say, you know what, that incentivizes schools to compete on quality because the kids look largely the same. That's what I've got.
Mike, can I start with a question? And Amber may not have the answer to this question. So I like the policy. I think it's fascinating. I'm mostly convinced, or at least I have no reason to question, that there's, you know, some positive impacts here. I guess what I'm struggling with is like competition, right? Like, who is incentivized exactly within the education blob to try harder, right? If the kids are moving around, right? Like, are there going to be staffing reductions at schools that get fewer students?
Yes.
Right? Or that, yeah, there are.
Yes.
Okay.
That's part of it. I did mention that in my quick 90 seconds.
Okay. I must have missed it. All right. I mean, and these teachers aren't just showing up at some other school somewhere the next year. I mean, that sounds like a pretty good policy to me. What do you think, Mike?
Yeah, look, it is. And this is, as I feel like we say a lot on the show, public school choice. You know, people don't talk about it that much. We kind of take it as a given. It seems to really work, especially if designed well. You think that, though, it's, you know, there's still plenty of places where there's not much of this going on. I also like this notion of saying, hey, unlike New York City, where we just say, we're going to give you a data dump of hundreds of high schools that you can choose from, we're going to try to keep it at least somewhat manageable and, you know, within some proximity, I assume, so that you can actually get your kids to these places.
Yeah, I guess I'm just wondering, is this actually what most public school choice looks like? I mean, have I just been thinking about this wrong? My assumption has always been that it's hard for a district to really generate in competition internally, right? In other words, that's not how we usually think about it here at Fordham, at least, right? We think about creating external entities that can literally take students from the district and make them jump a little higher, make them think seriously about how to keep the families, et cetera, and so forth. But, you know, I mean, if I'm taking what you're saying at face value here, it seems like they have constructed a system where there is real competition within the system and real incentives to improve. I don't know. My sense is that's a huge outlier, but maybe I'm just wrong about that.
I suspect you're right, David. I think that's right. I mean, to make sure that, you know, the people are not shielded from. I mean, I think anywhere where you've got a, you know, enrollment drop, that's going to have consequences for the principals in those schools and potentially the teachers, but it would have to be pretty significant for them to actually feel that, right?
Yeah. I guess I'm just wondering also, like, how much the broader enrollment decline. I mean, if they're going to be reducing staff anyway, I don't know. This feels like kind of, I mean, I don't want to call it a glide path, right? But it's as good a way as any to decide which staff to reduce, right? It's actually a better way than many, many other ways. If you're, maybe other districts can try this, right? You know, you're facing a giant funding cliff and kids are leaving the districts. Construct a, you know, a public school choice system and let parents decide which schools get to keep all their staff?
And not just for high schools, certainly for middle schools as well. Elementary gets harder maybe because people love their local school, but even there too. Yeah. And let parents vote with their feet.
I have to admit, I'm letting my center left colors show here, but I love the whole structured choice sort of, I don't want to call it controlled choice because that sounds bad, but I do think there is choice overload in many places. And I think we, the school choice community, such as we are, could do ourselves a huge favor just by not doing that to parents, right? And kind of, even if you can opt out of the initial sort of choice set, just giving people 5 to 10 choices that isn't completely overwhelming and is like, okay, these are the schools that we think are actually within driving distance. And here, we've given you this curated list that you may actually find helpful, right? And we're not trying to tell you what to do, but here's this list. I don't know. I just think it's a no-brainer to me, honestly, in terms of just helping the system work better and keeping parents satisfied. So I agree.
I thought it was quite comical. This is just not anything to do with what you just said. But apparently 10% of the principals in the sort of decade prior to when they were looking took administrative positions, you know, because their school was, you know, doing particularly well. And they had a little section in the report where principals sort of compete because being, you know, moved up to central office at the district headquarters is seen as, quote, a glittering prize. So it's like, literally, it's called a glittering prize in the study. So you've got this kind of interesting qualitative competition amongst the principals, apparently, as well.
Sounds like good material for a musical or a play, Mike.
Right? Oh, I love that. Yes. Although I thought that the, you know, conventional wisdom was sometimes that was all about, you know, the dance of the lemons or passing the trash.
Apparently not in LA.
All right, gang, we got to end there. That was super interesting. Thank you, Amber.
Yes, indeed.
But that is all the time we've got. So until next week.
I'm David Griffith.
And I'm Mike Petrilli of the Thomas B. Fordham Institute, signing off.
The Education Gadfly Show is a production of the Thomas B. Fordham Institute, located in Washington, D.C. For more information, visit us online at fordhaminstitute.org.